Blog Talk Radio.
Happy you're here with me for this episode of the Literary New England Radio Show. It's Monday, July 20th, 2015. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and tonight's show features three novelists, including two debut novelists. One of them is Adam Silvera, author of the YA novel More Happier Than Not. Adam is quite proudly, and deservedly so, a self-taught writer who made a conscious decision to stay away from MFA programs or fiction writing classes while he was writing his first book.
I think sometimes I'm too impressionable that if someone were trying to teach me writing, I would only believe that writing could exist in this, like, one guidebook. You know, that's why I don't really read craft books either.
Michelle Gable, author of A Paris Apartment, is our other debut novelist. And one of the things she makes quite clear in our interview is that getting a novel published was a goal she was not going to let not happen no matter what.
I just kept saying, I'll write a book, and if that book doesn't sell, I'll write another one, and another one, and another one. If my first book doesn't come out until I'm 85, then that's fine. You know, I will have had a lot of practice by then.
Also here with me is Sarah Hall, author of The Wolf Border, that's set in both the U.S. and the U.K. Sarah said that as she worked to craft her protagonist, Rachel, one of the things she wanted to explore is how people realize and use the choices they have in their lives.
I have friends that are psychologists, and I'm very interested in the idea of kind of damage and upbringing and how much control you have over your own life in terms of if you can see that something's been a problem for you, how do you appreciate that and then start to do something about it.
I have copies of each of the books to give away to you, starting with Adam Silvera's More Happy Than Not. Described as part Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and part Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, this YA novel tells the story of a Bronx, New York teen in the near future who's struggling whether to undergo a memory relief procedure that will help stop him from being gay. You can win a copy by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Adam was recently in New England, in Connecticut, among other parts of the East Coast, as part of the Openly YA book tour designed to celebrate gay characters in YA literature.
Oh, God, that was such a fantastic tour. So the premise of the Openly YA tour is to promote just gay representation in young adult literature, and being able to kind of attend that with David Levithan and a fellow debut, Will Walton, another award-winning author, Bill Konigsberg, and it was just, and James Dawson from the UK was just an amazing experience, and it was the first of two tours that I went on in June. So, but yeah, just talking about More Happy Than Not and getting to meet readers, it was just obviously incredible, and it feels like it's been years in the making. So then for the, that moment to actually hit where I'm signing books for them for all the, and it's also, I think my favorite part was actually finally getting to meet teenagers, because I've been fortunate enough to kind of tour earlier this year and meet a lot of librarians and booksellers, but now that the book is finally available for purchase, I was finally able to meet teenagers, which is obviously incredible, and they've been connecting so well to it. I'm just very grateful.
Well, please tell us about the novel. What's it all about?
Yes. So More Happy Than Not is about 16-year-old Aaron Soto, who's growing up in the South Bronx. At the same time, a memory alteration procedure has become available to the public. Essentially, what the LaTeo Institute offers are, just opportunities to relieve yourself of traumatic memories. And so it's less for, like, forgetting something, a Game of Thrones spoiler. It's more for like someone with like post-traumatic stress disorder or someone who just had kind of like a tragic childhood and is dealing with repercussions from that. What our narrator, Aaron, is hoping to accomplish with this procedure is he's hoping to turn himself straight, because he's kind of realizing that growing up gay in the South Bronx, which is, sometimes a little notorious for its violence, is not going to be a good move for him. So it's kind of a play on nurture versus nature, except science versus nature.
So your protagonist and narrator, Aaron Soto, just happens to have the same initials as you do. Is that coincidence?
This is, so there are a lot of, the book is kind of a semi-autobiographical, but originally Aaron's last name was Peters. It was Aaron Peters, but he's a Hispanic teenager, and I realized that that was not a very Spanish last name. So I just was kind of like looking around for the last names online, and I remembered I'd gone to high school with this dude whose last name was Soto, and I just loved the sound of it. I was like, Aaron Soto. The next day after I submitted it to my agent, I was like, oh, okay, I have the mirror identical, initials of Aaron, but it's great. Aaron is definitely an extension of me anyway, so I'm happy to share the AS love.
So now, you don't look very old to me.
I just turned 25 on June 7th, which was kind of funny because years ago I set out to publish a book before my 25th birthday. And when I sold More Happy Than Not to Soho Teen in December of 2013, it was originally slated for a fall 2015 publication, so this book still would not have even been out yet. And then they bumped up the publication for June. I think, it's kind of a book that takes Pride Month. It just seemed like good timing. And the pub date then changed to June 16th. And I was still short of missing my goal by a week. And then to accommodate that Openly YA tour, because, in order to, dispense copies early, we just decided to move up the pub date. And when Soho they asked her, they're like, hey, would you be okay with that? I'm like, that would be perfect. Like, I would be publishing More Happy Than Not 5 days before my 25th birthday. So I got to publish the book at 24, as I always wanted, and had a very underwhelming 25th birthday as a result.
But that's really fabulous. So is this... Gosh, you know what? It's almost, so I'm in my late 40s, and it's almost hard for me to ask like a 25-year-old, is this your dream? Because you still have so many dreams yet to come. But I guess to date, is having a novel published one of your dreams?
This was always the dream. So it's kind of, I'm definitely, I'm writing more books right now. I'm working on books 2 and 3. And I just, simultaneously, they're both YAs, both young adult novels as well. And, I definitely need, more life goals for myself now. But, I'm a very paranoid person. Like, I hate, up until this last tour, this 10-day tour I was just on, hated flying, was very paranoid. My whole thing for the past few years has been, I need to live long enough for me to launch my book. This is essentially my child, and it's a deep, extension of who I am. And it's been my biggest dream since I was, a teenager, and up until a point where I was 19 and starting to plot my own book for the first time, which wasn't More Happy Than Not. And then I set the goal for myself a couple of years ago to publish a book. For I turned 25, and it happened, and now I'm just kind of like, where do I go from here? But I just keep writing books and hope that I can sustain this as a career.
So why was this so important to you, Adam?
I didn't go to college. So for me, I needed some kind of goal. While all my friends were working towards a diploma, I was kind of like, well, I'm going to work towards a book deal. I had a lot of financial nonsense happen in my senior year of high school. I went to a private school where we just amassed huge debt, everyone was like, well, can't you just get support to pay for college? I'm like, college wasn't a problem. I had money put away for college that was exclusive for college. I couldn't touch that, but it was paying for high school. While I got a job at Barnes & Noble, while my mother and my family were helping, pay the rest of the tuition, and so I can eventually apply to colleges. But then by the time we paid it off, I had already gotten a job as a book reviewer. I was still working as a bookseller in Manhattan, and then I had an internship with, you know, a publishing team. So I was kind of like, let me see how far I can take this without actually going to college and, you know, amassing more debt. So, you know, I like to tell people that I essentially created my own MFA in creative writing by collecting all these jobs. You know, I worked as a bookseller, I worked as a book reviewer, I worked at you know, a creative writing platform for teenagers. I worked at a literary development company. I did marketing. I did editorial. You know, it's just I'm very familiar with the arena of publishing, and all these different jobs in their own way have helped me write my book. So, you know, I always kind of, I straddle the line between, like, whether or not I believe writing can be taught. It's something that I think was very inherent with me, and which I'm, you know, very grateful for. But, you know, as for, you know, I'm concerned about, like, what I think sometimes I'm too impressionable, that if someone were trying to teach me writing, I would only believe that writing could exist in this, like, one guidebook. You know, that's why I don't really read craft books either, because I'll start thinking, well, this person knows better than I do. Who am I to, like, go my own way about this? And writing is ultimately writing how you feel comfortable writing. So I'm really glad that this all worked out that way. And, you know, just setting the goal to publish for 25 just kind of kept me working really hard.
Wow. You're a pretty impressive guy.
I'm trying. Thank you.
You sound like someone who really knows what he wants.
Yeah, I just really, a lifetime of writing books would be amazing. And just being able to try different books and fail at some and succeed at others, you know, it would all be still kind of dreamy. So
do you write full time now, Adam?
I am writing full time. I still do some book reviewing and some marketing freelance on the side, but I work from home 100%, and I actually love these little pocket jobs, because these side jobs, because they, you know, they give me some additional structure in my life for when I'm getting too distracted by Netflix, and then that's been the hardest transition, you know, like really limiting my TV time now that I'm home all the time.
I understand. I work from home as well.
I mean, orange is the new black. Like, who can resist? So
I hear you.
It's fantastic. But yeah. So I'm working on books 2 and 3 right now, and some other little side projects. I'm very happy.
So that's pretty amazing. So now, who do you think would enjoy your book? Do you think it's written for a certain type of reader?
You know, I think it'll be enjoyed widely amongst, you know, young adults and adults. I do worry a little bit about someone younger than, you know, 13 reading it, just because there is some content. You know, I'm certainly not going to censor anyone from trying, if they believe that, you know, their child would be comfortable with it, or if the child himself knows that they'd be comfortable with certain material. But it's, you know, there's definitely some allusions to sex. There's mention of drug use. There's a lot of swearing, because that is just what my childhood was like, you know, just a bunch of 12-year-olds hanging out and cursing and behind our parents' backs and staying out late. And it's very authentic to my childhood. So, I've heard from tons of adults, more adults than I have teenagers right now even, about how well they're receiving the book. And I'm just very grateful.
That's fabulous. And as we read Aaron's story, what do we learn about Adam?
Yeah, I mean,
besides you were a cursor growing up.
Aaron is, you know, we share a lot of, I like to tell people we have like an emotional resonance together, but kind of diverged at a certain point. I think Aaron is a representation of what I was scared my life was going to be like if I came out at 16 years old. I came out at 20. I came out at 19, but for the general public, I started coming out around when I was 20 years old or whatever, but Aaron's story, does take some harsher tones, unfortunately, but that's just kind of the real life scenario of what I was scared was going to happen for me, but now I'm so happy that I've had kind of a happily ever after in my own life. I think people will recognize Aaron's story as being a little bit more of the more happy than not spectrum, but I think being more happy than not is ultimately very important for everyone across the board, just kind of accepting that, you know, 100% happiness is sometimes very hard to achieve, especially when you're dealing with, you know, such trials as like grief and heartbreak, and that, you know, ultimately if we can get back to a better headspace where we're a little bit happier, then, you know, it's not the end of the world, as we sometimes fool ourselves into believing it is. So I hope that everyone recognizes that and kind of takes away that message.
Adam, thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you. Oh, my God, this is so fantastic. Thank you so much.
Michelle Gable, author of A Paris Apartment, will be in New England on Saturday, August 8th, when she appears at Titcomb's Bookshop at East Sandwich, Massachusetts. That appearance will be at 2 p.m. Released last month as a paperback, which means it's perfect for throwing in beach bags or taking on vacation, A Paris Apartment focuses on a young woman named April, who works at Sotheby's and is sent to Paris to catalog the items in an apartment that's been locked tight for the past 70 years. While there in Paris, April discovers much more than the amazing riches and secrets of the woman who lived in the apartment. She was a courtesan. And with the help of a sexy Parisian solicitor, and also the woman's diaries, April discovers her own desires, her own secrets, and the choices she needs to make to live a happy and authentic life. Michelle and I started our conversation with where the idea for this story came from.
The true life nugget of the story is just amazing. My agent had seen an article about the apartment. This was in 2010. It was fresh off the heels of sort of a disappointment with another manuscript, and I was kind of wondering what I was going to do next, what I was going to write next. And my agent saw an article about this apartment that, you know, a woman had passed away in 2010 in the south of France, but they found out that 70 years before, she had an apartment in Paris in 1940. She locked the door to her apartment, left, and never returned. When they opened the apartment, it was just filled with the most unimaginable treasure you could ever fathom. Artwork, furniture, love notes, everything stocked, a hoarder, you know, almost a hoarder of the highest class, highest end of items. And so the question to me was, why did the woman leave the apartment? Why didn't she ever go back in 70 years? And kind of, I wanted to know also what it might have looked like to see that for the first time. And one of the main pieces that was found in there was a portrait of a woman that ended up selling for over 2 million euro at auction because it was painted by Boldini. And the woman in the portrait was the woman who passed away's grandmother, and she was a famous courtesan in the Belle Epoque. So that was the germ of the story that you know, allowed me to take off from there and interweave the historical and the modern day pieces.
And so how did you write it? I hope you went to Paris.
Well, I do go to Paris for work quite a bit. So I didn't go specifically to research this book, but I've been, you know, during the process. And I was actually in Paris when my agent called to say that the editor wanted to acquire the book. But I did tons of research, not only on the historical piece, but on the modern day piece as well. So in one of the pictures, and if you Google apartment shuttered for 70 years, you can see pictures of the apartment. In one of the pictures, there's sort of a bookshelf stacked with papers and little books, notebooks, and I decided that that was the courtesan's journals. And so the historical piece is told through the courtesan's journals, and the modern day piece is told through a Sotheby's auction expert who is tasked with, you know, getting the items in the apartment ready for sale. So I had to research both pieces of that because I don't know what it's like to work at Sotheby's, and I don't know what it's like to be a courtesan. So they, you know, I researched the era for the courtesan, but I also came across journals for a different courtesan, and she was a courtesan turned princess turned nun.
So, oh my gosh,
she's very interesting. So I spent probably months and months going through and researching both pieces of it. A lot of times I do many months of research leading to starting to write something, and then I'll do a bunch more research when I'm maybe three quarters of the way through writing it, because sometimes it's easier to see where the research fits in when you already have the bones of the story and you're not just trying to shove in something. Sometimes with research you want to like shove in a random fact because it's such an interesting fact, but maybe it doesn't fit with the story. So I use both pieces, and in the historical I tried to make the world very true to what this woman would have experienced during that era.
So A Paris Apartment was originally released as a hardcover in 2014. It was then re-released as a paperback just recently on June 30th.
Right.
Is that re-release equally exciting for you?
Yeah, it still just all feels so strange to me. You know, it's been a dream of mine since I was 10. My father gave me a book when I turned 10 called Someday You'll Write, and he re-gave the book to me at my launch for the hardcover, which was almost 30 years later. It was a few weeks before my 40th birthday. So it's something I've been wanting for so long. So it still seems strange to me if, you know, somebody well-known tweets about it, and my first thought is always, do they know my mother? You know, legitimately, I think, how did this person even hear of my book? Do they know my mother? So it's very exciting. You know, it's strange to think about it being the same book, but hopefully it finds a new audience. And, you know, I'm excited to get out and talk about it, get out on the road and talk about it again, and, you know, maybe talk about some new things as well. So it still feels very, very odd to me.
Now, you live out on the West Coast, but you do have ties to the East Coast. Will your book tour for the paperback release bring you to the East Coast?
Yes, I will be in Massachusetts. Will be one of my stops. I will also be in South Carolina and Pawleys Island, and then maybe a few other places. I went out to the D.C., Virginia area last year for the hardcover tour. I went to school in Virginia, and I lived in D.C. for many years.
And now you have a lovely website.
Thank
Is
you.
That the best place for people to go to find out the exact dates of where you're going to be and when they can meet you in person?
Absolutely. The tour dates are listed on the website.
And do you want to give us that web address?
Yes, it's michellegable.com. Michelle with two L's, GABLE.com.
And now you have a section on there about Michelle Gable, mm-hmm. which talks about how you had previously written a couple of books,
mm-hmm.
and they just didn't get published. But you had a lot of tenacity. I mean, this is going to happen for you no matter what, it seems.
Yeah, that was sort of my mantra. I just kept saying, I'll write a book, and if that book doesn't sell, I'll write another one and another one and another one. If my first book doesn't come out until I'm 85, then that's fine. You know, I will have had a lot of practice by then. You should, in theory, get better with each book you write. The last book, right before A Paris Apartment, that kind of was my... A lot of editors had liked it. It was going to go to auction, and at the last minute, all the editors dropped out of the auction, and their problem was they loved the book, but I was a debut author, and it was too hard to sell a debut author. So that was one moment that was a little bit difficult because I didn't know how to get over that hump. Yeah, I wasn't a real housewife of something, or I didn't have some other name. I was just, you know, a random person. So it was a couple weeks after that my agent had sent me the article about the apartment, and that ended up being the book that sold. And even though I was a debut author, I think the theme of Paris definitely helped in that manner. But it was, I did just keep going and promising myself that I would just write another one and another one. And it had been a hobby for so long and something I did for fun that, you know, it was, I could keep going with sort of that mindset.
Well, so now that you're a published author, does that previous book have a chance of getting a new life?
Maybe eventually. You know, my publisher wants things that are in similar feel and vein of A Paris Apartment. And that book is very different in tone and sort of subject and theme, so it doesn't fit, you know, necessarily. If you read A Paris Apartment and you went and picked up that book, you would think, oh, wait, what? You know, this isn't the same genre almost, but maybe eventually one day.
But you do have another novel coming out next spring.
Yes, I sure do, in February. called I'll See You in Paris.
How wonderful. And now what do you do for a living that allows you to travel to Paris?
I am the vice president of investor relations for a publicly traded software company. So we have investors in Europe, and we also, you know, go talk to potential investors in Europe. So that's what allows me to do that.
Oh, how fabulous.
Yeah, it's fun.
And so it sounds like you're still working that job and you're not now writing full time.
That's correct. Yep. Yep.
Do you have dreams of writing full time?
Not right now. I really do love my quote unquote day job or real job, as I call it. They've been very gracious to allow me time off to tour and do things like that. I enjoy getting out there and talking to investors. And so for now, you know, I'm able to do both. My kids are a bit older, so that helps. And I do think that the finance area, you know, I work at, my background is in finance. I do think that sort of helps with the writing, because you do have to be structured when you put together a story, and you have to be disciplined, and you have to put together, you know, you have to have the time. And I think sort of having this very, very, very busy and intense day job, it kind of helps with the writing, because I don't, you know, have to wait to get inspired, and I just get it done. And then the structure is just a natural thing for me, so I can dream and be creative and think of all these things as I'm, you know, going between meetings, or I'm making dinner for the kids, or I'm at the airport in the security line or on the plane. But I can also sit down and write when I need to sit down and write.
Michelle, it sounds like you have a pretty good life there going on.
I feel very lucky.
And is there something that you hope people are going to take away from reading A Paris Apartment?
I just want people to see it as an escape. When somebody said, or it inspires them to travel, or maybe look up, you know, some auctions, not, you know, not necessarily to bid on, but see what kind of items are there. When somebody says, hey, this really helped get me through, you know, I was in the hospital and it really helped me get through that time, just it felt like an escape, that is incredibly gratifying to me. I've had several people say it inspired them to book a trip to Paris with their mother, or with a sister, and that I love. So I just want people to, you know, and then on top of that, I love it anytime that a book sends me Googling and looking things up. So there's tons of factual pieces in there, even though it's fiction. And so that's a big thing for me, is I really, really hope it sends people Googling and trying to research little pieces of it.
And people can also go to your website, because you have a lot of great information and photographs about the actual apartment.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Michelle, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Win a copy of A Paris Apartment by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of The Wolf Border by Sarah Hall. Set primarily in Britain's Lake District, The Wolf Border is the story of zoologist Rachel Kane, who's asked by an eccentric earl to help reintroduce the gray wolf into the English countryside. The work brings Rachel to the village where she grew up and where her aging and estranged mom still lives. The blurb on the back of the book calls it a story that illuminates both our animal nature and humanity, as well as that explores sex, love, conflict, and the desire to understand our existence. But I wanted to hear how Sarah described it.
Well, the premise behind the novel is that a very wealthy landowner in Britain has an environmental project. He wants to reintroduce the grey wolf back to Britain, initially in a self-sustaining enclosure on his land, but he harbors the desire to kind of see apex predators come back throughout the British Isles, because as most people know, we don't really have any big predators left in this country.
So where did the story idea come from?
I think probably from my childhood. When I was growing up in the Lake District, there was a wildlife park very close by my house, and they had a wolf enclosure there, and they were the most spectacular creatures. You know, it was the one thing all the kids wanted to go and see in the park. Nobody cared about the boar or, you know, the owls or anything else. They really just wanted to go and see these wolves. They were mesmeric when you were a kid, and they were kind of habituated, so they would stare back out at you with those yellow eyes, and they were just They were incredible creatures. And I think just sort of that exposure to them when I was young meant that there was something aesthetic about them that I fell in love with very early on. And it's the creature that really does it for me. You know, I think a lot of people have a totemic creature that that for some reason, whatever it is, they feel not an affinity for, but an enjoyment of. And wolves have always been it for me right from childhood.
It sounds like you were not a bit afraid of these wolves.
I think I probably was on some level, but they were behind a cage, so you kind of knew they weren't really going to come out and get you. Although, you know, interestingly, I say wolves don't exist in this country anymore. They are in fairy tales, of course, and folk tales. So as a kid, you'd probably have in mind the idea that, you know, whenever a wolf is mentioned, it's not in a good context, gets a haunted quality to them. So I think probably I carried that around with me too. But seeing these animals in the wild, it wasn't really in the wild, of course, but they looked so good against the background. That's the thing about wolves. They look so good wherever they are. They blend in with all kinds of different environments. I remember them seeming really, really to fit well in the landscape.
So now you grew up in the Lake District. Yes?
I did, yes.
And the Wolf Border is set in the Lake District. I was in the Lake District once about 10 years ago, and it has stuck with me because it has to be one of the most magnificent places I've ever been. For those who've never been there, can you tell us about the setting of this book?
Yeah, I mean, so the landscape of the Lake District, as you know, as the name suggests, it has a lot of lakes and rivers and waterfalls, and, you know, upland streams and waterways, and mountains. Nothing as large as Scottish standards, certainly nothing as large as North American standards, but it's really quite a dramatic setting. You know, you have these tight little valleys with towering crags and things. And of course, it's a territory that's been made famous by Wordsworth and the Romantics. So it has that association, a literary association and a physical association. And it was an amazing place to grow up as a kid. I had a very free-ranging childhood. My brother and I were let out of the house in the morning, and we would just kind of gallivant all over the moors and, you know, swim in the rivers and just have a fantastic time outside. So, you know, it was really an extension of how we were brought up, I think, the landscape.
Oh, and see, even you talking about it, it sounds so beautiful. And now your protagonist is Rachel Kane. Tell us about her.
She's a strange character. She's not immediately sympathetic. She's quite a cool character and very, very self-sufficient. And, you know, she's been working on these wolf projects across the globe, really, wherever there's a job to do with wolves, she's travelled around a lot. And she has quite a troubled relationship with her family. So the novel sees her trying to come to terms with that and restore some of the broken relationships that she's had over the years. And all this has made her quite emotionally closed off. And the journey of the novel is really the kind of humanizing of Rachel, really. She has her good qualities, but she really needs to begin to understand what human relationships are about. And I think this is true of lots of women. You know, sometimes people think, oh, women have it cracked. You know, they're much more emotional, you know, of the sexes. And I don't think that's true. I think women can struggle just as much as men with getting relationships right. So really, that's part of the journey. Alongside the reintroduction of these wolves, you have Rachel kind of growing into an emotional environment, if you like.
And is she based on a real person?
No, she's not really. I mean, she's got hardy aspects to her that I think on a good day I would like to say I have some similar aspects. I mean, she was brought up in much the way that I was, although I have much happier family relationships than she has. But I was very interested. I have friends that are psychologists, and I'm very interested in the idea of kind of damage and upbringing and how much control you have over your own life in terms of if you can see that something's been a problem for you, how do you appreciate that and then start to do something about it? I'm always hugely admiring of anyone that's come through adversity or come through a difficult upbringing and has managed to kind of turn it around and through self-awareness and often hard work and just human compassion that they're interested in becoming a better person in a way. And I see that about Rachel. That's what I was really interested in with her.
And I know The Wolf Border is your fifth novel, Sarah. Have all your novels been published in the U.S.?
They have, yes, they have, and by the same publisher, so I'm very lucky. I have these quite loyal publishers across the world, which is really lovely because you develop a relationship with the same publishers there. But this is really only another one of my novels has been partly set in America. The Electric Michelangelo was set partly in Coney Island. So The Wolf Border, the opening sections are in Idaho, which is very interesting for me to write about and think about making comparisons between America and the UK, especially to do with wilderness. The thing that America really understands is national parks and what you have to do with your wilderness to look after it. And I think Britain could probably learn a lot from that model.
And did you take a field trip to Idaho?
I did, actually. My ex-husband, who's still a very good friend of mine, is from the Pacific Northwest, so we spent a lot of time up there with his family. And he was brought up in Clarkston, which is right on the Washington-Idaho border. So I did a couple of runs up into Idaho. And I went to see the Sawtooth Pack, actually, once, and didn't manage to see them. But, it's a very, very interesting state, I think, but lots of different reasons, politically, environmentally. It's got a lot going on. It's an interesting place.
And you are such a skilled writer. I think your prose is just gorgeous. You were twice nominated for the Man Booker Prize. Do you feel any pressure when you sit down to write a novel that it has to be written a certain way? I mean, certainly you want to write a good story. You want to write a great story. But does your success either help or perhaps hinder you in some way when it's time for a new project?
Novels are such big things that you really have to immerse yourself in the research and the writing and the editing for several years. And I think that's the primary thing. You lose yourself a bit and you forget about everything else. At some point, you're coming back to the notion of, how is this book going to be received in the world, and the first port of call with readers. But I think, it's such a personal thing that you're kind of wrapped up in. It's terribly selfish in a way. You're kind of wrapped up in your own ideas for a while, and everything else is sort of oblivious. And the pressure is to make every book as good as it can be, in fact, better than the last. So I feel that's probably the pressure. And I do understand I've been very lucky with prizes, but I've judged a lot of prizes as well at this point, and I do understand that, there are strange vectors around why and when certain awards might come your way, and you just have to kind of turn away from it, and if anything happens, just feel very lucky, but just get on with the day-to-day.
What was the hardest part of writing The Wolf Border?
The research was quite hard. I did a lot of wolf research, which meant I became a very boring dinner guest because I was just recounting facts about wolves to anyone that would listen. But because I was so fascinated by them, I felt the whole world should be interested in,
of course,
the idea that a wolf can swim for 8 miles. I mean, come on, who doesn't want to know that? But so that was pretty tough. But the thing I worried most about was actually writing about motherhood, because I had not yet had any children. I have a daughter now, but I wrote the book before I was pregnant. So that, and although that's a common experience, lots of my friends and family have had children, it's also a very intense personal experience, and I wanted to make sure that I'd got it right. So that was the thing I was worrying about more than anything else.
So were you writing this book while you were pregnant?
I edited the book while I was pregnant. So the first draft finished before I was pregnant, and then I edited during. And I had a brief period just after my daughter was born where I was able to go back and do the very last line work, and, you know, which was nice because I had the opportunity to kind of feed in another few little details that, you know, felt particular to me, but, you know, but were authentic. So I did have the chance to to correct here and there, but on the whole, I felt it was okay.
And I know on you have a great website, sarahhallauthor.com, and it mentions under personal appearances other events in London, Carlisle, Hay, Edinburgh, France, and the USA to be announced soon. Any plans to come here?
I hope so soon. Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of deep into motherhood at the moment, and you know, my daughter's only 11 months old, so traveling any great distance can be tough. But I hope soon. And actually, I was very lucky to be the recipient of the E.M. Forster Award last year, which bestows on you funds to travel in America and explore America. So I'll certainly be doing that within the next 3 years, I think.
Well, how very exciting. And are you working on something now?
I am. I'm nearly finished another collection of short stories. I'm just kind of putting that together now, and then I'll be editing it. So that is the next project. And it's. I love writing short stories. I think, you know, secretly, if I could only do that, I might do that. But I mean, I love novels, but they're so big and they really take it out of you. It feels like you run a marathon every time you finish one. But there's something about short stories. I love the form. It's such a challenge. So that's what I'm working on now.
Well, it's a great time for short stories. They're becoming much more popular. They're booming again.
That's true. That's true. And I think, you know, especially in the UK, it used to be that, you know, the form has always been really respected in America, I think, and it's taught in the universities, and there are such, you know, great, great masters of short story form in, you know, in American literature. And the UK, I think, we kind of lost touch with the short story for a while, but there are several, you know, there are several big prizes now, and publishers are more interested in publishing collections again. So there's a bit of a renaissance happening here, which is fantastic, I think.
It is fantastic. I always love to hear that. And Sarah, we need to kind of wrap things up, but The Wolf Border, why should someone pick it up? What will they get from reading it?
Oh my goodness. What a question.
That's a hard question, huh?
Well, I think they'll get the Lake District. If they've never been to the Lake District, hopefully I've put a lot of love and care into describing the territory. And as a reader, I absolutely love it if an author can, you know, create this evocative world that I've never been to, but I feel I'm there and I can smell it and it's wonderful and I can see it. So that's what I try to do with my landscapes. And I think certainly that's on offer in the book. But and there are wolves. Who doesn't love wolves? They can swim 8 miles. Come on.
Come on. I agree with you 100%. Sarah, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
If you haven't yet tried to win a copy of More Happy Than Not, A Paris Apartment, or The Wolf Border, it's not too late. Be in the running for any of these titles by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. While you're doing that, I want to thank our terrific guests tonight. So thank you, Adam Silvera, Sarah Hall, and Michelle Gable. If you missed any part of tonight's show, in just a few minutes, the entire episode of this Literary New England radio show will be available in the Lit New England archives. In fact, all of our past episodes are there, dating back to the very first one in December 2011. In fact, if you scroll back to December 2011 and you tweet @LitNewEngland with one of the names of the guests on that very first show, I might pick your name and send you a gift box containing 5 books by authors who've been on the show. I'm actually looking at some fabulous titles on my bookshelf right now, and it would be great fun for me to put together a box of some of my favorites in the hopes that you would love these books just as much too. So give it a shot. Send that tweet to @LitNewEngland with the name of a guest on that very first show, and you might be the winner. And no matter what, I always love to hear from you, so please send a tweet or an email anytime. The Literary New England Radio Show will be back next week with more author interviews and terrific book giveaways, and I hope you'll be there too. Until then, I wish you a great week and great reading.